Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The lead singer of the pop group Pulp, Jarvis Cocker, has strenuously denied allegations that he attacked three children performing with Michael Jackson at last night's Brit Award ceremony. Jackson said he was sickened by the whole incident, and Cocker ran onto the stage during his live performance.
Oasis will begin their American tour without Liam Gallagher on vocals. Liam walked out on the band this week, 15 minutes before he was due to fly out to Chicago for Oasis' first concert. Liam also failed to perform at Oasis' MTV Unplugged show in London last Friday. The audience was told he had a sore throat.
Within the last hour, there's been an explosion in Manchester city centre. It follows a security alert earlier this morning. Police say that bomb disposal experts were working on a vehicle when a device of some sort detonated. They say a coded warning had been received, but it's not clear from whom.
So, mate, have you got any tickets for Euro 96?
Do you know of anyone who's got any Euro 96 tickets?
Do you know any tarts or agencies as well?
I don't take liberties, even with myself. I know I prepare professionally for a football match, and I've always done that, and I always will do that. The only thing that does disappoint me is that the public pick up the paper, and they're going to believe all they're reading it, and we're made out to have had a three-week party here, you know, before each game.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With us, of course, is Jonathan Wilson. And our guest today is the comedian Mark Watson. Mark, pleasure to have you on the pod.
Nice to be here. Yeah. Well, I guess weird not being able to see anyone, but that's just life these days, isn't it?
That's lockdown life, my friend, I'm afraid.
I started saying nice to be here, and I thought I'm just in my house as usual.
Yeah, well, you're in the listeners' ears, as Jonathan and I are. So in a sense, it's a three-pronged attack. We're in it together.
We've got three up front here, basically. We should find a way through.
Unlike the two teams that are in question today, we go back to Euro 96, Scotland 0, England 2 at Wembley Stadium on a very sunny day. Mark, why have you chosen this match?
Yeah, the idea of playing three up front would have seemed insane in those days. I think this match has got quite a bit of significance in my memory for a few reasons, really. I was 16 at the time, so I was a kind of Britpop teenager, and it was a very specific time in the kind of social history of this country, I suppose, where there was this kind of wave of optimism. As everyone remembers, the Cool Britannia thing, this weird, slightly heady atmosphere with all these bands. It's hard to look back on it now and put it in perspective, but it was quite an fun time to be growing up. And on top of this, obviously England hadn't been at the World Cup 2 years before and had done really badly at the Euros before that. So there was a sort of hunger for England to do well in something again. And I think for me as well, I mean, I still follow England, of course, and watch these tournaments, but there's something about the rawness of supporting your country when you're that age, I think. I'd had Italia 90 was a kind of seminal tournament for anyone my sort of generation. It was the kind of emotional roller coaster of that, the Cameroon game, the penalty shootout, Gascoigne's tears, all that stuff was really kind of hardwired into us. And then, as I say, there'd been a drought of England being good ever since then. So I remember feeling going into Euro 96, plus, of course, we were hosting it ourselves. Mm-hmm. So although I wasn't going to any games or anywhere near going to any games, I was basically, I went into Euro 96 in a state of near unbelievable anticipation. And as I say, I still do. I got very caught up in England's World Cup bid in Russia. I still love international football, but there is something about those kind of first few big summer tournaments of your life that you never quite forget, I think. Mm. However, the first game, England started well and then threw a lead away and drew with Switzerland, I think it was.
Yeah.
And, well, it definitely was. And there was, I remember sort of sense that all this optimism for England was already dissipating and there was a slight apprehension that we might have a sort of massively embarrassing host nation going out in the first round situation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mark. I think with England, Jonathan, you know, after, as Mark says, World Cup 90, there was, you know, it was just semi-final, England came close. And then after that, you sort of had the Graham Taylor years of England, which was very underwhelming and disappointing. So there was a lot on England when Terry Venables, there was a lot of, I suppose, what would you say? People wanted Venables to pick England up when he took over in the mid-90s and do something with them, but it hadn't been brilliant. If you remember the Umbro Cup or whatever it was, that bespoke tournament, and some of the friendly matches England played going into Euro 96, Jonathan, England were very underwhelming.
Yeah, they were. But I think it is difficult when you don't have qualifiers to play. And so because the games really don't matter, you know, you can play badly in an important qualifier, win 1-0, and all people care about is the fact you won 1-0. The friendlies, you know, England had some awful games. And we know what friendlies can be like. You never quite know what the opposition, you know, how much they care, whether they're putting out a strong team. There's always a tendency to experiment. And of course, immediately before the tournament, there'd been that absolutely disastrous trip to China and Hong Kong.
Yeah.
When you'd had the dentist's chair, you'd had Gaza tipping pints over people, then the plane on the way back, the Cathay Pacific flight, when your Gaza was asleep and somebody slapped him awake and he thinks it's Alan Shearer says it's not. But anyway, he sort of went berserk and two TV screens got smashed and Dennis Wise got put in the overhead locker. And there's this enormous embarrassment.
At this point, when it doesn't sound like a team that's going to win trophy.
Yeah, but there is that sort of sense that when, you know, Venables, I think, dealt with it very well, that he said, we're not going to hang any of you out to dry. And the phrase he used was, we're taking collective responsibility. And I think there is a sense that teams can be bonded by that. And I think, you know, something similar had happened in 1990 when there was all kinds of allegations about England players and a barmaid at the resort where they were staying. And sort of this sense of, you know, the siege mentality against the press, you know, the press are all out for us.
Yeah, there was also
in certain contexts that can bring them together.
Yeah, in 1990, there was massive negativity from the press going into that tournament, I remember as well, and after the opening game with Ireland. And there was a sense, again, that the players and Robson developed that sort of us against the world mentality in the rest of that tournament. But coming into Euro 96, as you say, there'd been all these shenanigans in the Far East, but there'd been very few actual matches to judge England by. So it is true that there was this kind of, as I remember it, there was this kind of heady optimism. And then England scored early in the opening game.
That's
and then
right.
Even in the course of that 90 minutes, you could feel the optimism disintegrating and the country like ready to turn on Venables at the drop of a hat. So it felt very precarious, I think, going into the Scotland game.
Yeah, but I think the point you make about the general optimism of Cool Britannia and Danny Boyle and Damien Hirst, and that sense of Britain sort of, you know, almost finding a new sense of self and after 16 years of Conservative government, a confidence that that government was coming to an end and Labour suddenly looked very electable for the first time in a long time.
Yeah.
And I think from what you were saying, I think I'm 4 years older than you. So I turned 20 4 weeks after this game. And I have to say, this summer is the best time I've ever had. It's the best time of my life without question.
I'm glad you say that because, as I say, I do look back on it as a really delirious summer, but sometimes you wonder if you're just mythologizing your teenage years.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, I think your age must be part of that. My first year at university, my final exam was on the afternoon of this game, which is another story I'll come to.
On the Saturday afternoon?
On a Saturday, I had one in the morning and one in the afternoon. It was a nightmare. I might as well tell the story now we've got into it.
But yeah,
it's pretty much the only thing I've ever done in my life where I've looked vaguely cool. And even that word feels difficult in my mouth. But it was
not easy to call yourself cool, is it, and come away with any credit?
No, it's not. But there were two Anglo-Saxon papers. Coolness in the Anglo-Saxon context, perhaps even harder. In the morning,
you have to heavily caveat this coolness with the fact that you're doing Anglo-Saxon in the first place.
So there was essays in the morning. So there had been six exams, two each day for 3 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So the essay paper in the morning, 3 hours, and the afternoon was a 2.5 hour translation paper. There was I can't remember how many it was, but it was a number of texts, and you knew they'd choose, I don't know, half a dozen of these texts, and you had to translate four of them. So because I knew it was the afternoon of this game, and because in those days I had a really good memory, I just learned the translations off by heart. So I knew I'd be able to get into the exam, look at the first
whichever
line,
passage it was, you'd have it nailed on. Yeah.
Just write it down. So I'd done this. It's pretty much the only paper I'd really kind of worked really hard for. We went in. I think it started at 2:30. So the game was at 3 o'clock, and I think the exam started at 2:30.
I can't imagine going into an exam room with this game looming.
That would be awful.
Because it's Oxford, we have to wear, the ridiculous sub-fusc, gown and mortarboard and bow tie and everything. And
hot afternoon.
On a stifling hot afternoon. There I am in this exam. They give the normal spiel before, which I have to say I'd never really listened to before, but they said very specifically here, we will not let you out until an hour has passed, an hour of this 2.5 hour paper. And I was sort of thinking, do they always say that? Or have they just said that this afternoon because they realise that everybody's going to want to get off and watch this game?
Out of there. Yeah.
So, opened the paper, rattled it off. It was finished in 25 minutes. And so I better check it again because I'm probably not going to be able to go for 35 minutes. I check it through, 40 minutes gone. And I was like, I can't add anything to this. This is as good as it's going to get. So I think, right, well, I'll see if they really are going to stop me when I walk out. So I thought I'll make a point of scraping my chair really noisily and hopefully that'll provoke other people also to leave. And sure enough, as I scrape my chair back, half a dozen other people, obviously in a similar boat, all stand up. And we leave. And
everyone with England shirts under the sub.
And you can see the invigilators looking at each other and obviously think, just let them go. So go out in the street and sort of sprint back to college. The gown sort of flowing behind me. Get into college. And I said to people, don't worry, I'll be back by half time. And, I wasn't particularly confident myself I'd get back by half time. But this is even 20 minutes gone by the time I sort of burst into college. And I run through the quad to the TV room. And the window was open, the outside window was open. And so without really thinking, I just sort of jumped through the window, landed on the ground, did a full forward roll next to the TV and landed in a sitting position facing the TV all in one movement.
That is like something from a cartoon.
The best thing I've ever done. And as I sort of gain my sort of equilibrium, somebody just reaches over a bottle of lager and just puts it in my hand.
That's like an advert. That's like what would happen on an advert for an aspirational young person's beer or something.
Yeah, exactly. But that is by a million miles the best thing I've ever done. But just generally that summer, because I then had, I don't know, a week or 10 days when I had nothing to do. And it wasn't like being an adult when you have nothing to do, when actually you still have loads of stuff to do. I had no concerns at all, no worries at all. So every day was just playing football in the sun, watching Euro 96, drinking. having a brilliant time. And
there's nothing quite like the summer of an international tournament is a wonderful time. I think those like long afternoons, you've got your beer, those days when you get three games in a day, all that sort of thing.
Oh, it's glorious.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I think that optimism kind of stretches further than that. You know, I think it was just an optimistic time for the world that, you know, the communism had come to an end. You know, you had Francis Fukuyama and the end of history. You had a Dayton Peace Accord.
It looks like history is still going now, isn't it, unfortunately?
Sadly, yeah.
he may have gone a bit early with that.
You had the Dayton Peace Accord the previous December. And, of course, the day of this game, which seems an extraordinary thing now, you'd had the bomb at the Arndale Centre in Manchester.
Yeah.
But even that, although obviously a terrible event, it felt very much that conflict was over. This was sort of the last sort of flailing of the real militants. But actually, there was peace in Ireland as well. So I think optimism is exactly what that summer was all about. And the football tournament played into that perfectly from an England point of view.
Yeah. And yet going into that Scotland game, you were aware that we were a defeat away from everything coming, going to ashes. And on top of that, there was this England-Scotland business. I was old enough, and I'm old enough to remember when you had things like the Rouse Cup and the annual fixture between England and Scotland, but it hadn't happened. I don't think England had played them for quite a few years leading up to this game. So without having anything against any Scottish people, or even knowing any Scottish people, I had the sense this was basically a massive derby and that it would be the end of the world if we lost. I remember both me and my brother, who's younger, being like almost too nervous to eat breakfast that morning.
Mark,
wait till 3 o'clock was absolutely unbearable.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Edinburgh, in Scotland, of course, and I always, my parents, all my family's English. Now, I'd always supported Scotland and England, but up until a very distinct point going to school there, it became quite obvious that your average local wasn't up for me doing that, if you see what I mean. And so, you know, if it's put upon you that you are something that they're not and you can't do that, blah, 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 the chances are you're not going to kind of kindly agree with them and go, okay, yeah, you're absolutely right, I'll go with you guys. So I then became a bit more of an England fan. And at this point, so I was 14 when the game happened, so very much in that sort of crap period at secondary school before you kind of go off into more GCSEs in England and standard grades in Scotland. And I mean, if you were nervous, I was petrified, because if England had lost this game, I think I would have campaigned my parents to move down south, you know.
Yeah, you had a lot to lose. You had a lot.
Oh, my goodness, I really did. Yeah.
Whereas I don't think at that point I knew a single Scottish person, but I did have my dad had a lot of old football annuals, yearbooks and things, Rothmans and so on from the 70s and 80s. And so I'd seen images of Scotland fans tearing up the goalposts at Wembley and all this business. So I was massively indignant about that on behalf of the England, even though I wasn't alive at that point. So I had it. Yeah. I had myself riled up for an enormous derby, even though if we had lost, it wouldn't have been like I could have come into contact with any Scottish people. I think one thing about support line Bristol City fan, I think if you support a team that's slightly lower down the pecking order, you do sometimes get more intensity out of England games because you have been starved of those massive occasions. When you hear people say, I don't care about England as much, it often is people who's, you know, they have five or six enormous club games in their season. Well, Liverpool is a separate concern. I suppose there are certain places that see themselves as a bit distinct from England. But in general, this thing of don't really care about World Cups, don't really care about the Euros, feels to me like a sort of a big team's luxury. I think for me, as a supporting a mostly second, third tier club at that point, the idea of England v Scotland felt like the major event of my life so far.
I know what you mean. All right, chaps, let's have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about the match itself. Back in a second.
So welcome to Wembley for England against Scotland, the oldest international fixture of them all. First played way back in November 1872. That one finished 0-0. The hopes are that this one will have a few goals as well. Ooh, there was a lot of space on the far side, but McManaman seems the man of the moment here now. Finds Neville with it. There's the cross coming in.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
He just says, how many holes does a straw have? 0, 1, or 2? The internet can't figure it out, so I've done what any sane person would do. Ask the Luke and the Pete.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Luke Moore for an unplanned half hour every Monday and Thursday as we talk about, well, anything really, from your emails to life's great mysteries to this guy.
The noise you're going to hear sounds like a man being interrupted by a car. He isn't being interrupted by the car. He is making the car sound.
Sina, that's a hippie.
Por qué?
How on earth is he doing that? Beep, 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 beep. How does he make that noise? Listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Beep, 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 beep.
The Luke and Pete Show is a Stakhanov production.
Now, let's see whether McAllister's nerve will hold. Holds his head, and Scotland denied an equalising goal.
Welcome back to the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Now, Mark, you mentioned earlier that the game before this was England versus Switzerland. And I think alluding to games before that in the Far East, England had beaten a Hong Kong 11 side 1-0, which was hardly the ideal prep. They go into the tournament. The first game, you think, OK, this is what England need to host a tournament, get themselves going again. They had a decent squad of players. And it was a real damp squib after Alan Shearer had put England 1-0 up. Switzerland equalised. And to be honest, England probably, you know, fairly happy to get away with a point in the end. So going into the Scotland game, a lot going on. And Scotland had drawn 0-0 with the Netherlands before and played pretty well. And it was a decent Scotland side, Mark.
Yeah, it's hard to, I mean, you know, hard to believe in a way now because it's been so long since we've seen Scotland in a major tournament. But in those days, they almost always were there. And yeah, I suppose it was McCoist, McAllister, Gary McAllister. There were enough good players to make you feel that England could have some trouble. And of course, Scotland went in with a gigantic underdog thing. It was obvious that if they were to beat England at Wembley in this showpiece tournament for England, it would be a massive kind of David and Goliath thing. And even at a distance, you could tell how much the Scots relished being in that position. So it did all feel very much like England were perhaps being set up for a humiliating fall. And that Switzerland game, I remember it having this atmosphere which is familiar to, and which we've seen replicated in almost every opening England game of my lifetime, where it starts well. For about 30, 40 minutes, there's this bullishness, like, oh, we actually look like one of the best teams in this tournament. You concede an equaliser, you can see the weight of expectation crushing the players, and you're lucky in the end to get to a draw.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I pretty very much what I thought was going to happen in Russia, where we were playing brilliantly against Tunisia, then
got
pegged back. Yeah. It looked like an archetypal England opening 1-1.
And yeah, when Kane scored, stupid penalty,
all of this. And that's why as soon as Kane scored very, very late on in that game, I think I'd gone into that thinking it did feel different. I think I went into it thinking, it'd be nice if England did well in this tournament, but, you know, we've seen this all before. And by the end of that game, I found myself right out of my seat when Kane scored. And that was why. It was because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, this never happens. It's always 1-1.
So, I mean, Jonathan, the Scotland team, you know, it's not a bad spine for a side. You know, Andy Gorham in goal, who I maintain is one of the best goalkeepers of his generation. I think down south, it's not really realised.
No, I would agree with that. Absolutely, yeah.
Uh-huh. Calderwood and Hendry at the back. You know, the midfield of Stuart McCall, Gary McAllister, John Collins. I mean, my goodness, you know, it's not too shabby. And Gordon Jury up front. I mean, it's a good Scotland team with the
really good side. And, you know, McCoist didn't even get a start. You know, it was Spencer and Jury who started, and McCoist came on really through the second half. So, no, when I look back at the teams, it was sort of a slight shock at just how good that Scottish team was. And, you know, Craig Brown's teams were always, whatever the personnel, were always well organised.
Yeah, you knew they were going to be stubborn. You knew going into it that it was going to be an attritional, one of those games where your stress levels never drop.
Yeah, that's right. The England team going into it weren't too bad. Now, Jonathan, am I right? A part of me thinks it was a 4-4-2 to begin with, and obviously it was a change at half-time we'll get to. Is that how you have it down?
It was. I mean, there's some weird perceptions about that tournament. England played with a back three, which I think is because David Platt played it right back against Spain in the quarterfinal. So it does look like there's five midfielders there. But essentially, they only played with a back three in the second half of this game. And even then, only until the 85th minute when Sol Campbell came on for Jamie Redknapp, who'd been a substitute. But of course,
starting with a back three in those days would have been very unorthodox, I think.
Yeah, quite. I mean, I think there was sort of an affection for it because it had worked in the World Cup in 1990, or, you know, back five, I guess that was. But even there, Bobby Robson repeatedly in games reverted to a back four. You know, the final few minutes against West Germany in the semi-final, it was a back four again. So, you know, there was a real suspicion about not playing with a back four. But, you know, the other thing before this game had been that after the Switzerland game, Jamie Redknapp, Teddy Sheringham and Sol Campbell had all been, you know, photographed in Faces Nightclub in Gant's Hill near Ilford.
That's right.
Drinking bottles of lager. So, you know, all that stuff about, oh, we've learned our lessons from the Cathay Pacific flight. And, you know, who knows? Maybe it was one bottle of beer, which doesn't really matter. But it looked really, really bad. And there was a sense of, you know, these incorrigible players, you just will not leave the booze alone.
Exactly. All, again, feeding into this idea that we were one defeat away from a total meltdown, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the posture from the Switzerland game was that Shearer had scored again. That he'd gone 21 months, 1,088 minutes without scoring for England. And, I mean, there was talk about should Shearer be dropped, which in retrospect looks crazy. And even in the build-up to the Scotland game, Arnold Meeran was there saying, oh, Teddy Sheringham will never make it in national football, he's too slow.
There was all this swirling around, and you did feel that if we started the game badly, you could already see it all like getting ready to collapse.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary affair. This game, that the background to it as well, or the setting rather, Wembley Stadium, sunny afternoon, 3 o'clock kickoff. It felt like a cup final, in the sense that you're familiar with all the players. It's an all sort of British affair, if you like. And it was an international tournament, because international tournaments previously, of course, and subsequently, have been played on foreign soil very seldom. You know, obviously England played Wales in the Euros years later, but it tends to be against foreign opposition. So this game, you know, as I say, Wembley, 3 o'clock, sunny day, classic sort of FA Cup final feeling to it. But yet that's not what it was. But as soon as the game started, I just remember the roar of the crowd and everyone was going in, and it really felt like some sort of gladiatorial duel. And it was, I mean, the first half was quite forgettable, but the sense of occasion, Jonathan, was definitely there straight from the off.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it was a very British occasion in every respect, but particularly in the sense of the football, which was pretty miserable that first half. And if you think back to the game against Ireland in 1990, and the famous Italian headline, "No football, please, we're British."
No football, please, we're British, yeah.
Which would have annoyed the Irish, to be fair.
Yeah, it would have done, yeah.
Yeah, it was a politically dodgy headline there.
You sort of know where it was coming from, this idea that you know, British football is very much about the two banks of four. It's about being pragmatic, playing in percentages, you're hitting long diagonals. And I think that's why Venables' willingness to switch at half-time. I mean, imagine if that had gone wrong. Mm. Imagine if he switched to a back three and taken off Stuart Pearce, of all people, to take off you know, the Lionheart himself. And if that had gone wrong, Venables was finished.
Or Redknapp.
It was Redknapp came on.
Redknapp
was already playing.
God, looking back, Redknapp came on for Pearce. Yeah. Substitution, really.
Yeah, so we went to a back three of Neville, Adams and Southgate with Anderton and McManaman as the two wing-backs.
As two, yeah, I don't think I would have wanted to tell Pearce at half-time that was happening.
Yeah, I think
I do remember, that's my main memory of the afternoon, or at least one of them, is how desperate the football was in the first half and this sense of depression starting to build that after all this, and you could feel the atmosphere coming off the TV set. It was a feverish kind of intensity to it, and as you said, it was very, very much like a cup final. But for someone like me, it was
playing into Scotland's hands, really, because at halftime, I just remember the Scotland fans singing and dancing because they were loving this. Because you know, a point would have been okay for them because they'd have played the Dutch and then England at Wembley. They would have just had Switzerland left. It wasn't a bad Switzerland side, of course. They'd got a respectable point against England. But on paper, their two hardest games would have been over with and they would have been in a good position to qualify for the next round. Yeah, and England,
I definitely remember at halftime, having a cup of tea, thinking, as you say, you could see how happy the Scotland fans were. There'd barely been a shot on goal. It appeared to have 0-0 written all over it, or even worse, one of these games you lose in the final 10 minutes to a deflection or something.
But Jonathan, England was so much better though after the break.
Yeah, I mean, immediately the switch to the back three was vindicated. That, I mean, even the fact that Gary Neville, although notionally playing on the right side of a back three, got forward to get the cross in.
Oh yeah.
But you know, there was that extra width there. I think what had probably happened was that Jamie Redknapp had sort of dropped in almost as a sweeper, which had liberated Neville to go forward. Mm-hmm. But he suddenly is on an overlap, and you see the Scottish defence is slow to get across. Just because, you know, there's the extra man coming through midfield, he's got time to measure his cross. It's a classic Gary Neville cross that there's no great whip on it, there's no great pace in it, but it's just put in the right area, and Shearer with a classic Shearer header to finish it.
I can visualise it, actually. The Shearer header very easily if I close my eyes. And I remember the sense of tension being released was absolutely enormous.
I think that
I've never that yearned so much for a goal as I had in that game.
I think, Mark, was that the moment that, because I suppose, well, you could argue that this goal was maybe another false dawn as well in the sort of the microcosm. But when Shearer scored against Switzerland, I think everybody thought, we're up and running, the tournament's away. And there's always that moment where any national side wants that moment, that goal or moment to think, right, we're up and running. And it felt...
Yeah, there was this huge sense of we have liftoff now. But as you say, as with so many times in England's history, it turned out to be an illusion. because not too long after that, I suppose we did win the game in the end, but this for the second game running, a penalty came along.
Yeah. But before the penalty,
yeah, the showing Sheringham went from Gascoigne free kick. Gorman makes a fantastic save.
He does.
Low to his right to push it out.
Should have put
it. But then Scotland do come back into it. And Seaman makes a really good save from a Gordon Dewey header from across from Spencer. And suddenly, I don't know, around about 70 minutes, 75 minutes, Scotland are in the ascendant. And you're thinking, yeah, exactly. This is the Switzerland game all over again.
It really was. And there was this age-old feeling that you get of England being 1-0 up and gradually digging their own grave. A thing which many times.
Going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, which England team, I mean, I guess they still do it, but it seems such a feature of 80s and 90s England teams.
It was certainly what happened in that Ireland game, wasn't it?
Yeah. Simon Cooper has this great line that this desire to reenact Mafeking at every stage, but it's like sort of a glorious siege is our sort of, you know, it's what we understand Dunkirk or Mafeking or whatever. Terry Butcher with a blood-soaked bandage, Rome in 97. And this sort of, there's this belief that that's what courage and that's what football and that's what heart is all about.
We love to batten down the hatches, basically.
Yeah, well, actually courage is playing passing football in the opposition's half. And that's actually how you win games.
Yeah, and if you are an England fan, there is that dread that you start to feel in your heart as you see the 1-0 lead kind of swinging precariously in the breeze and you see the players starting to... That feeling of watching a team... I mean, it's not just an England thing. Anytime you're watching a team just getting deeper and deeper in the hope of clinging on, it's one of the most stressful things that a football fan can watch, I think.
Yeah, I think England have seldom have we seen England teams sit on a 1-0 lead and do it well. And as you say, that when Teddy Sheringham has that header and Gorham makes brilliant save, Scotland wake up as you mentioned, and they were knocking on the door and they were on top. And it was Seaman saved. There was a Seaman picked up a Gary Neville, what was deemed to be a pass back. There's free kick in the box that came to nothing, and you could sense there was something happening. And then, of course, Jonathan Tony Adams dives in and fouls Gordon Dewey to give away a penalty.
I mean, the Adams's reaction there is absolutely brilliant. But yeah, it's a nice move from Scotland. You know, McAllister and McCall to Dewey, and Dewey's tripped by Adams, but he gets up and he sort of wipes his hands on the sides of his shorts, and sort of
could not look
more guilty. You know, He is the absolute image of somebody who knows they've committed the foul and is trying to pretend nothing's going on. But by doing that, they've somehow made it even more obvious.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? And so, in the Italian players of that era or Spanish, you know, had that wagging the finger, massive gesture, like operatic gestures of despair. Someone like Adams, his whole face and body language basically said, yeah, well, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the penalty against Switzerland was arguably slightly harsh in that the ball was driven into Pierce's hand from not very far away. This one is the most blatant penalty you could ever wish to see. No questions, no doubts.
But Adam said after, Pierluigi Pareto
gives it.
But Adam says a few years later in an interview after, he still maintained that he got the ball.
Well, he got a little bit of Dewey as well, though, to be fair.
A fair bit of Dewey, yeah.
I remember being... So we were watching this in the living room on the ground floor of our house, and my mum was out in the garden, very little interest in football. Me and my dad and my brother locked into this. And when the penalty was awarded, I was so furious with Adams and so full of despair that I left the room and went out onto my parents' patio as if to say, I'm done with this, not watching this anymore. My mum looked up in alarm because I must have looked like sort of something from a Greek tragedy or something. I was already accepted the penalty is going to be scored. I was already I'd already written it off. And she said, oh no, if they scored. And I remember shouting across the lawn, it's a penalty. And then my dad calmly called me back in. He had more faith in David Seaman than I did.
Yeah. Well, when I mentioned earlier about Shearer's header, you know, was that another sort of false dawn? You know, we, as you say, Mark, we thought we had liftoff. Here was the moment where we thought, oh no, we're back down to earth again. And of course, a combination of David Seaman and Yuri Geller, Jonathan, were the heroes of the day for England.
I forgot Geller bailed us out of that one.
Yeah,
he doesn't get enough credit often. Man. Yeah, like a 12th man.
If anybody listening doesn't know who Yuri Geller is or what we're talking about, just keep it that way, I'd say. But Jonathan, Gary McAllister, such a good footballer, very trusty. When I think of McAllister taking penalties, I think of, you know, putting one top corner for Liverpool against Barcelona and so on. Always so reliable. And obviously, it was, you know, it's a decent save. But looking back on it, even though obviously really wanting England to win, I felt sorry for McAllister, and I felt that it didn't, that penalty to sort of didn't represent him and his skill set, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think he you know, he quite rightly had a reputation for being a very cool and calm player, technically obviously very gifted. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, if it was a criticism of him, it was that he lacked a little bit of pace. But there's nobody, I don't think of the 22 players on that pitch, I don't think there's anybody you'd rather have taking the penalty.
Yeah.
Just because it, temperamentally, you know, he's the last man who's going to bottle it.
This was, and part, then the of ball my, part of my despair, really. I remember seeing McAllister with the ball under his arm and sort of absolute dead-eyed. And, you know, sometimes you get a feeling, looking at a penalty taker, sort of gut instinct that he's going to miss it. You definitely didn't get that with McAllister.
Yeah, but the ball just wobbles. Yuri Geller makes the ball slightly. Wobble.
Yuri Geller just moves the ball fractionally off the spot, and it's enough to unsettle McAllister.
The ball and does move. If you watch
it definitely moves, yeah.
It's really weird.
That's not the bit I'm disputing.
We're just disputing exactly how much Geller had to do with it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things you just can't prove, so, you know. But the thing is, it is a strange penalty for McAllister, because he was very much a sort of calmly placed. The only thing I can think is that his plan was to wait for Seaman to move and to smash it straight down the middle. And then if the ball moves slightly to the left, which I think is the way it went, he would slightly cut across it. And so, as it turned out, hit it into Seaman's dive. But even then, there's a remarkable bit of luck that the ball hits Seaman on the elbow. You know, he doesn't sort of get a palm to it. He's not able to direct it. Just hits his elbow. And, you know, half an inch higher, that's flicking off the elbow into the roof of the net. But it hits the elbow and just loops up and goes over the bar.
It just all conspired in England's favour in that moment, basically. And of course, because of what followed with Gascoigne, I'd still look back on that as one of the most sort of intense 5-minute periods of football that I can remember.
Absolutely. I mean, it's within a minute. England out.
Yeah, there
the
you
round.
Go. That is how I remember it, but I wonder if I was misremembering how sudden it was.
No, there was, I think Scotland must have taken a corner, must have been an offence from the corner.
Colin Hendra, I think, fouled somebody. I think it was.
Yeah, because on the highlights I saw, it's just, it goes from a save to Seaman taking a free kick. And the ball's worked down the pitch in two or three passes, inside to Gascoigne. Gascoigne lifts it over Colin Hendry's head. And it's one of those moments where, as the ball drops, you have absolutely no doubt that ball's in the back of the net. There's something about his body shape, about the certainty of a skill that's gone before, if it just says absolute dead certain goal. Yeah. And he buries it past Gorham and runs off. Teddy Sheringham's there doing a dentist chair thing with the water bottle. And suddenly this sort of great shame of Hong Kong and the Cathay Pacific flight is turned into sort of this big joke, and kind of look at this sort of new catharsis. Laddish culture that somehow is cathartic and yeah, it's somehow exactly. That's all redeemed, and it just doesn't matter anymore. It's just lads being lads.
That's right. And it's funny, in that moment, in those few minutes of football, you felt like the seeds of the next game when they thrashed Holland and were all sown. It felt like that moment with Gascoigne, the loop over Hendry, the
that
finish,
was liftoff.
And that mad kind of celebration, which I don't think I knew what was going on, the dentist chair thing, but I definitely liked it.
But I think the thing about that goal as well is, when have you ever seen an England player score a goal like that?
Yeah.
Oh, it was an extraordinary bit of skill. And Gascoigne had that in him, of course, in those days. He had that weird, was it sort of half bleached hair or something? He was very distinctive looking.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
He had that tendency to, I mean, everyone knew what Gascoigne was capable of, basically, even at this point in his career. And I think all of us that had loved him in Italia 90 and we'd been on that emotional journey with him, there was a kind of longing for Gazza to do exactly that sort of thing. You knew he still was that guy deep down. So I think that was part of it as well. There wasn't anyone an England fan wanted to see do something special more than Gascoigne.
Yeah, yes. But if you just, you know, if you think back to Italia 90, however much fun that was, the goals in it, there was a, you know, a header from a free kick. There was Lineker bundling it in against Ireland, against West Germany. There's two penalties against Cameroon. There's a cross and a header against Cameroon.
It's only David Platt's goal that you can actually, you know, picture with any. And even that was just a free kick.
It's a free kick, yeah. I mean, it's a brilliant finish, but it's a free kick.
Nonetheless, yeah, the idea of going box to box like that, basically. And
the imagination and the confidence and the audacity. Yeah, that's exactly the word, the audacity to flick it over a defender's head and then volley it in.
Yeah, it was just, as you say, not the sort of thing that England did. It wasn't the sort, you could almost not believe your eyes.
Yeah, and I think because that worked, it then gives England the confidence to play as it did against the Dutch, and particularly that third goal against the Dutch, which, again, it, you know, required a moment of confidence and imagination and audacity that England players, you know, that idea of the heavy shirt just stops you doing it. But that was the moment the heavy shirt came off.
I think this is why it's such a special game for me in my memory, because by the end of it, you did feel as if England had gone through some sort of psychological barrier. And I remember coming home from school on the following, whatever it was, Tuesday, Wednesday, for the Holland game, and you could sense at Wembley there was a sort of swagger about it. Although it was unbelievable to beat the Dutch in that manner, suddenly it didn't seem as unlikely that England could do stuff like that.
Mm. And of course, by the end of the tournament, all psychological barriers were removed from the England football team forevermore.
That's right. And now we've got quite a few trophies in the bank now, thanks to that one day. You can't help thinking that if we had gone on to win the shootout against West Germany, maybe we would have seen all future barriers removed. Maybe that could have been, you know, the whole tournament could have been a kind of watermark in English football.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and I think the sense of false dawn, not only did they lose the shootout to Germany, but then immediately after that, you know, we'd seen all these sort of, you know, the great images of fans mingling in the stadium and, you know, the sort of the reclamation of the flag as being something very positive, and all that positive energy. And then what happens after the penalty shootout defeat? There's people out on the street smashing up German cars. There's a Russian student being stabbed because people think he's German. And it turned out nothing had really changed at all. That all this optimism was going to come to naught.
Yeah, yet again, you saw how England, the national mood of England during the tournament is like a little bit schizophrenic. It goes from massive euphoria to this terrible negativity, which is directed outwards at foreigners. Mm-hmm. And it was very... I don't feel that with the World Cup in Russia, perhaps because we never expected to get anywhere near the semifinals, I didn't feel that the reaction was quite as kind of grim as that this time. It feels as if, but maybe that is just because it felt like sort of a bonus to go as far as they had.
Mm. But it's funny to link the two tournaments because, you know, Gareth Southgate's obviously one common denominator there. The man who misses the penalty would be the man who would, I mean, if England haven't gotten over the psychological barrier of penalty shootouts, they've certainly smashed a few holes and put a few dents in the barrier. Yeah, with two
winning one with Southgate as manager is a great sort of storyline.
Exactly, and going on in the UEFA Nations League, you know, if anyone's interested. But still, it's a penalty shootout win. But the other common denominator between those two tournaments, of course, was the song. You had Three Lions was the song in Euro '96, and yes, you had different versions of it in '98 and so on. But really, World Cup 2018 was where it picked that song up again, and there was that same kind of feeling, but slightly different, and hopefully a bit more modern, Mark, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, England football fans are always having to get reality checks at various points. I think this is the World Cup just gone is the first one, or one of the first ones I can remember where it genuinely did feel as if the pressure was off a bit, because people just thought, well, despite the enthusiasm for Southgate and despite what looked like quite an easy group, I still think people thought, I've seen all this before. The win over Colombia was another one of these national turning point moments where, again, you felt like that is possible then. We can win shootouts. We are not bottlers. And although, yet again, you could argue it was a false dawn because we did blow an enormous chance to get to the final, it's still nice to hope that something is a little bit different in the psyche of English football since that summer.
I think the feelings as well, when England went out at Euro 96, there was such despair. And looking back on that, it's the best chance in my generation that England have had to win a tournament, because surely against Czech Republic with home support, you'd fancy England to do it. Whereas when they went out in Russia in the World Cup, then there was a sense of, do you know what, actually there's hope for the future. Whereas I think in Euro 96, Jonathan, perhaps there was, I suppose, a sort of general despair of what had just happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was optimism for the future in that it felt like England had found a new way of playing. It felt like there was a new mood. A lot of those players were pretty young, and you had people like Robbie Fowler who's in the squad who you know, he got a handful of minutes, but essentially hadn't really been used. Shearer was absolutely, you know, at his peak. It was before the injury slowed him down. So, you know, I think that there was optimism. I think to an extent that was justified in Le Tournoi, and even England's performances in France in 98. Although they end up going out in the last 16, they played some good football in that tournament.
Yeah.
But you're right. There was an enormous sense of opportunity missed, because it wasn't a good Germany side. It was, by German standards, that was a poor side. And I think you're absolutely right. Surely against the Czech Republic, England would have had too much at Wembley.
You'll never underestimate
the capacity of England to mess it up. But then, you're right. They've never had a chance.
Last night I watched the Diego Maradona documentary with my son, who's 10, and watching West Germany and Argentina line up for that final, even 30 years on, I was still a little bit furious that wasn't us against Argentina. For the exact same reason. Who knows what would have happened, especially with the sort of Maradona's talismanic thing. But again, it was such a poor Argentina side by then. Both of those semi-final defeats of the 90s, you can't help looking back with a heavy sense of what if. Whereas,
you're right. 1990 seemed to be set up for England's redemption for 86.
Exactly. It just wasn't quite to be. Whereas, at least in Russia, I think we still would have lost to France, probably.
Well, I think that's what kind of gives me peace of mind. I've never been sure of a result in all my life in that France. Once they got to the final in Russia, they were going to win it. I think they were the best team. And in 1990, looking back, I think West Germany were probably the best side in that tournament. And I don't really have sort of too many complaints, because England had actually probably had their best game in the knockouts against West Germany. But Euro 96, I just think, that was such an opportunity for England. But of course, as we've all sort of said and alluded to, that's what it is being an England fan, Mark. You know, it is about the what ifs and so on.
It is, and sometimes you think that's, I mean, not exactly part of the joy of it, but there is, it's a part of what makes being an England fan sort of special experience, is that sense of ourselves as either eternal underdogs or the people that always blow it, or it gives you a sort of underdog identity. At least I sometimes wonder what it would be like if you were my age and German and you'd already seen maybe three major trophy wins in your lifetime. It's hard to imagine being in that mentality, and of course it would be nice, but apart from it, it's a little bit like as a Bristol City fan, I sometimes look at fans of Manchester City or really any respectable sized club and think, what is it like having seen all those trophies, had all those moments of glory? Of course, I'd love to have it, but there is something about staying hungry. I suppose that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think the pressure, if you win all the time, must be awful. I've mentioned this before on this podcast, but when Sunderland won the 73 FA Cup final, which I wasn't born at that stage, but my dad was there, and he was 35, he'd have been. And he said that, he'd spent 20 minutes whistling for the end of the game, and the final whistle blows, and his first reaction wasn't ecstasy, it wasn't joy, it was sadness, because he knew it would never be that good again.
That's funny, isn't it? And that encompasses, that epitomises the problem of being a football fan, basically.
Still got to come. That's the good news.
Yeah, exactly.
To be fair, yeah. I'm pretty confident I haven't had my "this is the best it'll ever be." At least I bloody hope not.
Indeed. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure talking to you about Euro 96 and a little bit of England in general as well. I mean, of course, we might have been talking about Euro 2020 had all this business not happened, but we certainly hope that England can host and do something special at the Euros in 2021 or whenever they may be. But thank you very much, Mark, for being on the podcast. It's been a pleasure having you.
It's a pleasure. And I hope one day someone else will do a podcast about how we blew it at Euro 21.
Yeah, I've absolutely no doubt. For more stories like this, of course, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. But until next week, thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
And we'll see you very, very soon, everybody. Cheers.
Oh, here's Gascoigne. Gascoigne, he can finish it here.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered